Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you news from across Ukraine. We analyze the impact of the passing of the massive US aid bill to Ukraine on Saturday, and we sit down with an expert to understand foreign investment in Ukraine during the full-scale invasion.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Monday, the 22nd of April, 2 years and 58 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols and US editor Tony Diver. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Hi, David. Hi, everybody. So a busy weekend across the country in Ukraine, mainly centre and east, though, to be honest. Russian attacks continued throughout the weekend, causing civilian deaths and injuries across the country, mainly in Donetsk Oblast, Kherson, Zaporizhia. Zaporizhia saw 202 strikes across six communities, although amazingly no casualties reported there. The city of Nikopol also was hit by artillery fire. That was last night. That's near the city of Dnipro. And then in Kharkiv, also injuries there as well. Ukrainian forces say they shot down five Shahed-type drones over Odessa Oblast. Some damage on the ground, but again, amazingly, no casualties reported. Elsewhere on the front line, so in Luhansk area, Russia seemed to have marginally advanced west of Kremina. The fighting there seems mostly in the lines of Kupiansk, Savatovaya, Kremina. Then slightly further to the south in Donetsk, Russian forces continued to push in the Bakhmut area yesterday. No confirmed advances there. Ukrainian military sources said that Russian forces had unsuccessfully attacked east of Siversk. The Russian MOD claimed that some elements of their forces, no size given, had seized Bolodnivka, that's northeast of Chasiv Yar. There's no geolocated or no way to verify that, and no other evidence that that is correct. However, a Ukrainian National Guard officer said that Russian forces had managed to secure positions in the Bolodnivka area, where they transferred significant materiel and established well-prepared defensive positions. Now, the National Guard officer did not specify if Russian forces controlled Bolodnivka itself, and the assessment there is that they're trying to use that. They're trying to surround Chasiv Yar or take Chasiv Yar. Remember, by May the 9th, Russia's Victory Day parade, or Victory Day, which there is a parade, and it looks like Bolodnivka might be the sort of shoulder to the north of Chasiv Yar that they're going to try and pivot around, as well as trying to seize Ivanivka, that's to the southeast of Chasiv Yar, to come in from the south. So it looks like they're trying to do another an envelopment there, as they did with Bakhmut, and to a certain extent, Avdiivka. Chasiv Yar itself, Russian forces continuing to attack the city and the surrounding area, but no confirmed advances there. Ukrainian military officials said that there were no Russian troops inside the city itself yet. And one spokesperson said the Russian forces are attempting to use combined arms, so combat vehicles, helicopters and infantry attacking there. Now then, Ukraine has also been very active. Ukrainian forces are very active over the weekend. They're said to have struck and damaged another ship from Russia's Black Sea fleet. So the Komuna submarine support ship, said to be the world's oldest active-duty naval vessel, was hit in Sevastopol. Geolocated footage published yesterday shows a fire and a smoke plume in the bay. Russian sources claim that air defences had intercepted a Ukrainian anti-ship missile in the area, but maybe one or at least one other got through. Open source analyst H.I. Sutton, you'll see his Covert Shores website is well worth a read. He noted that Komuna provides the Russian Navy with very valuable capabilities and frequently participated in sea trials and can conduct seabed warfare. We've written many, many times in the last few years, really, about how Russia is trying to interfere with undersea cables, internet cables, through which huge amounts of the world's traffic and financial data. Now, Kirill Budanov, General Budanov, the head of Ukraine's military intelligence, he's been speaking to the BBC. It's another media organisation based here in London. He said Ukraine's about to face a, what he calls, difficult but not catastrophic situation on the front line in the near future, he says, starting from mid-May. He gave an interview which was published this morning, although he was speaking on April the 19th, which is last Friday? 21, yeah, something like that. Anyway, speaking a few days ago, before the vote in the US approved the additional aid, which Tony's going to speak about shortly, his words probably would have changed little. But he said, a difficult situation awaits us in the near future, but it will not be catastrophic. Let's be clear. He said, there will be no Armageddon, as many are saying. We will not talk about it at length now, but there will be a difficult period mid-May, early June. I think that still stands. ISW, the Institute for the Study of War, speaking about the effect of the vote over the weekend, said that two things leap out. Russia will likely intensify ongoing offensive operations, including missile and drone strikes, in the coming weeks in order to exploit what they call, this ISW call, the closing window of Ukrainian material constraints. And they secondly suggest they assess that Ukraine will likely be in a significantly improved operational position by June this year, regardless of delays in any arrival of US security assistance. The Russian military command will likely consider significant changes to the large-scale offensive operation that many have been saying is expected to launch in June, although it may well still proceed as planned. Now, those two, obviously, in relation to the vote over the weekend, and unlikely, because of the time frame, that General Budanov would have rode back from any of the comments that he made on the 19th. And then just a final one for me, David. We've just put this out. The US has warned that China is now, what they say, the primary contributor to Russia's war in Ukraine and wider military expansion through the provision of critical components for weaponry. So Antony Blinken, U.S. Secretary of State, speaking on Friday, said Beijing's supply of machine tools, semiconductors and other parts key to producing weapons is contributing to what he said was the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War. He added that Washington had made it very clear to Beijing and others that they shouldn't be aiding Russia's war effort. This was a part of the, he was speaking as part of the G7 foreign ministers on the island of Capri in the Gulf of Naples. He said, when it comes to Russia's defense industrial base, the primary contributor in this moment to that is China. We see China sharing machine tools, semiconductors, other dual-use items that have helped Russia rebuild the defense industrial base. China can't have it both ways. It can't afford that. You want to have positive, friendly relations with countries in Europe, and at the same time, you are fueling the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War. Now, they many other discussions, Capri, including what's going on in Gaza, and also the missile exchanges between Israel and Iran. Washington, making no bones about how it's expecting European allies to ramp up pressure on China to help dissuade it from assisting Russia. In an assessment last week, the US accused Beijing of helping Russia undertake what they say its most ambitious defense expansion since the Soviet era and on a faster timeline than we believed possible. I think those last words there rather telling. But they say Chinese assistance to Russia includes materiel and technology that is key to the manufacturing of missiles, drones, tanks and aircraft, and as well as other stuff. Mr. Blinken's criticism of Beijing was echoed by Annalena Baerbock, Germany's foreign minister. She said, if China openly pursues an ever closer partnership with Russia, which is waging an illegal war against Ukraine, we cannot accept this. You remember, just before the start of the full-scale invasion, Russia and China declared they had a no-limits partnership. They've not rowed back from that since. Long-standing, long-reported suspicions about China supplying vital components to Moscow. Ukrainian officials have made it very clear that they are finding an increasing number of Chinese components, in particular electronics, in Russian weapons on the battlefield. Western sanctions that are designed to restrict companies from supplying military and dual-use items, i.e. those things that can be repurposed for military application. They've meant that Russia's obviously turned elsewhere. We know they're looking to North Korea for artillery. They've gone, obviously, to Iran for drones, and they're also turning to Beijing increasingly for technology. Ukrainian officials say they found Chinese-made components in a navigation system fitted in aerial drones that had previously used a Swiss system. And they also found Chinese parts in fire control systems in Russian tanks, which prior to Western sanctions, those specific parts had been made in France. So a lot of pressure or increased pressure on China. David and the US very much looking for Europe now to sort of ramp up their effort in this area as well. And I'll need to take a pause and to disappear there, David, if that's OK. I've got to get back to my mental health first aid training course. So I'll bid you adieu.
Well, thank you very much for that summary, Dom Nichols. Tony Diver, let's go to you next. The US aid bill passed on Saturday. Take us through the day. What were we reporting on? What did it feel like on the Hill?
Well, good morning, David. Yeah, pretty major news from the Hill this weekend. I feel like I've been on this podcast so many times telling you that nothing's really changed and we're going into yet more interminable negotiations over how the government might get this bill passed. Well, finally, it's happened. I can talk you through all of the detail, but the short version is basically that Joe Biden's request for just over $60 billion worth of US lethal aid to Ukraine has got through the House of Representatives. That's its first hurdle and most difficult hurdle in order to receiving approval. That means if it gets through, and we think that will probably happen this week, that an extra $60 billion budget is magically created in the Pentagon, which allows Joe Biden to send weapons to Ukraine from existing US military stockpiles under what's known as the Presidential Drawdown Authority. And that means that basically weapons that are already stored by the US in Europe, in stockpiles all over the continent, can start to move towards Ukraine as soon as that bill is signed. And that means basically we could be seeing the delivery of some pretty serious US weapons to Ukraine within the next few days. So it's a very major update in this long-running saga. It ends a six-month impasse in Congress where Republicans and Democrats have been at each other's throats over this bill. And it also marks a pretty significant shift in policy from the House Speaker, Mike Johnson. He's in charge of controlling business in the House of Representatives and bringing legislation to representatives. And his decision to bring this bill forward and allow it to pass with the support in the large part from Democrats who are on the opposite side to him is a pretty significant one, and he's taking a lot of flak for that.
Well, Tony, there's a lot to get into here. Can we start with Mike Johnson? Do we have a sense of what changed his mind here? What's the story there?
Yeah, there's a fascinating story to be told here about Mike Johnson, a Louisiana representative. He's not been in the House for very long. He was an unlikely choice for Speaker last October when Kevin McCarthy, the previous Speaker, was ousted by the same group of Republicans in his own party. At the time, he's never been a great supporter of Ukraine, I think it's fair to say. You know, the last point we had a major crunch moment like this was in May 2022. At that point, it wasn't actually the majority of Republicans in Congress who were opposed to spending more money on Ukraine. There was a vote in May 2022, about 50, 55, 57, something like that, Republicans opposed sending more money, and Mike Johnson was among them. So it was fair to say that he at one stage was one of the kind of Republican hardliners that was pushing against this kind of package. Well, all that's totally changed now, and he's become the man who's facilitated it. And he actually gave a very interesting interview after the events of Saturday, in which he basically said that he decided to act against his own political interests in order to do what he said was the right thing. He said, my philosophy is to do the right thing and let the chips fall where they may. He says, if I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, which is a vote of no confidence to you and I, then I would never be able to do my job. look, history judges us for what we do, he said. This is a critical time right now. So a sort of damaging conversion here from Mike Johnson, who has suddenly come out and said, actually, he thinks that passing this is the right thing to do, that it's a moment of history, some words that I think it's fair to say he borrowed from the president himself, and that bill has finally got through.
And what does this mean, do you think, for the Republican Party? We had a question from a listener. I'll just read that out. This is from Charlie, who says, majority of US House Republicans voted against the Ukraine aid bill, despite the fact that most polls suggest a supermajority of Republican voters strongly support Ukraine aid. Why the discrepancy? What does this mean for the Republican Party?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and the question that people are asking here on the Hill. Let's just do the numbers first. So there were 112 Republicans who voted against this package on Saturday. That's of a total 217 Republicans in Congress, which is slightly more than half, as the maths wizards among us will be able to work out. The Republicans have a slight majority, a very small majority in the House, which means that in normal times, nothing without Republicans, full Republican support can get through. That's why he needs to rely on these Democrat votes. In response to the question, though, I think the picture is slightly more complicated than that. And actually, the latest polls don't necessarily show that a supermajority of Republicans are supportive of Ukraine. Actually, the latest Gallup poll, which came out earlier this month, shows that actually relatively few Republicans want to see the war continue and the US funding it in its existing form. They would rather see some kind of negotiated end to the war involving Ukraine ceding territory to Russia. So in a poll, 77% of Democrats said that they prefer helping Ukraine reclaim the land that it's lost to Russia, but that's only true of 45% of Republicans. And when you look at a separate question which asks whether or not the US is doing enough, there are 60% of Democrats who say the US isn't doing enough, but only 15% of Republicans say that. So what we're actually seeing is a shift in the Republican voting base towards the position on the Ukraine war held by Donald Trump, which is that we should try and bring a negotiated and speedy end to the war in one way or another, but almost certainly involving territory given up by Ukraine to Russia, whereas Democrats are much more likely to support sending weapons to Kyiv for them to continue fighting. So I think actually it's not perhaps quite as straightforward as that. If you ask a straightforward question, do you support Ukraine, you probably would get a majority from those Republicans, but exactly how you support Ukraine and how you get there is a slightly more complicated question. So I think some of those Republicans who voted against this bill can quite reasonably claim to be supporting the views of a majority or a very large minority of the Republican Party. In terms of what happens in politics and what's going to happen next on the Hill, we've already seen several calls for Mike Johnson to step down because of this support for the bill and for his willingness to work with Democrats on it. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is the kind of Republican conservative hardliner who's been leading these efforts against him, came out immediately, accused Mike Johnson straight after the vote of betraying the American people. She said she's going to be pushing for a motion to vacate to try and get rid of him as soon as possible. And she's been backed publicly by two other Republican representatives. So it's fair to say there's not a huge groundswell of opposition to Mike Johnson after this, but there is a lot of grumbling going on. If we may see a vote on a motion to vacate this week, it's very unlikely to pass. But I think this is a decision which has put a lot of noses out of joint, not least among the House Freedom Caucus, which is the kind of hardline Republican group which generally aligns itself with Donald Trump and definitely aligns itself against working with Democrats.
Well, Tony, you've spoken about Trump a few times now. What does this mean for him? Has there been any change of position from Donald Trump as this bill passed? What do you think this means for the Republican nominee heading into the election in November?
Well, I thought it was interesting, actually, that we didn't get an immediate response from Donald Trump on this vote, actually. We normally, in a major political moment like this, we'd normally see Donald Trump jump on it immediately. And that's partly for kind of PR reasons, because he wants things that he's saying about stories to go into write-ups. Actually, what we saw was him posting on Truth Social about his criminal trials and the one that's starting today with opening arguments in New York. We didn't see an immediate response from him. His position on all of this is very interesting. I mean, he has a long-standing position, which I've just outlined, which is that he thinks Ukraine should be trying to bring this war to a negotiated settlement. He said that if he was president, he'd end the war in one day. He doesn't think that the US should be spending billions of taxpayers' dollars on funding weapons for Kyiv. But he has come out in support of Mike Johnson. The interesting fact here is that, you know, as Mike Johnson was facing huge opposition to his speakership from some Republicans on that kind of MAGA wing of the party a couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump held a press conference where he went out with Mike Johnson and said he's doing a great job under difficult circumstances. So I think it's very unlikely that we're going to see a major policy shift from Donald Trump, but he is slightly caught here between his publicly stated position, which is in support of the speaker, and the position of his own supporters in Congress who are very strongly against him. In terms of what this means, I mean, that's all kind of beltway politics, but looking at what this actually means in terms of funding. The whole point of this package, as designed by the White House, to put forward $60 billion, the largest ever package that's been given to Ukraine in one go, is to try and get enough support in the bank before the election in November, because the White House is very concerned that this has been such a difficult package to pass. It's not really possible to do what they did at the beginning of the war, which is come to Congress incrementally with a few billion here and a few billion there and ask it to go through on a vote, because it's so difficult to get one of these passed. The White House drew up what's become known as the one and done strategy, which is to pass $60 billion all in one go and say, right, that's it, there's your budget until November, and we'll spend it until then. So, I mean, obviously what happens beyond November when there's a new president or a second Biden term is a completely different question, which we probably don't really have time to get into here. But the point, I think, to be made is that this is now basically a settled issue. The money's been sorted, providing it gets through the Senate later this week, and Donald Trump is going to have to accept that.
What happens now? So we've got the Senate vote. Are the people supporting this bill, I mean, do they believe it'll pass through that? And what happens then? Is that it? Everything clicks into gear and the shells and the equipment start rolling off the production lines? What happens?
Pretty much that is it, yeah. There is a lot more support for Ukraine and for this kind of package in the Senate, which is Democrat controlled. And so Chuck Schumer, who's the majority leader, the Democrat majority leader in the Senate, has said that he expects a vote to be held early this week, possibly tomorrow. So that will basically be a straight up and down vote in which senators will have their say. We might see a little bit of debate, which might be interesting to those of us who are following the politics of it. But basically what we're expecting to see is the Senate pass it. Joe Biden has said he will sign it the second it hits his desk, which is the next thing that happens after it's been through the Senate. And once that's happened, it basically opens up this budget in the Pentagon, which allows the US to send the supplies that it's already got in Europe. So, I mean, really, the actual nuts and bolts of this are pretty bureaucratic. This is all about whether or not there's money in spreadsheet in the Pentagon to pay for this stuff. In reality, what it means is that the president can authorize the use of these kinds of weapons, the sort of weapons that we spend a lot of time on this podcast discussing, but, you know, ASICAM missiles, Patriot missiles, possibility of more tanks, and all the stuff that Volodymyr Zelensky has been calling for over the last few months, he says he's running short of, and, you know, where he feels he's been outgunned by Russia on the front lines. So once it gets through, we're expecting to see the White House move extremely fast and start actually getting this stuff onto trucks and moving from their current location, largely in Germany, but also in other places in Europe and into Ukraine, where they can then be used by Kyiv.
And just finally, Tony, what does this mean for Biden? I mean, there was some criticism that we've heard quite a bit of criticism of the White House, of the slow moving and sort of reaction to Ukraine's request for aid. What does this mean for his authority in the Democratic Party? And what does it mean for him as a leader, you know, the purported leader of the free world?
Well, in the Democratic Party, he faces broad support for his position. Democrats have always supported this package, and there's been a lot of frustration about Republicans who have been trying to block it. I think there has been criticism of Joe Biden, you're right. I mean, in terms of how he's handled this politically, and whether or not he's moved quickly enough and nimbly enough, I think he has been faced with a pretty difficult job here, which is trying to get an unpopular package through a Republican-controlled House. And, you know, he is facing the same issues that every president before him has faced, which is when the House goes against you, it's very difficult to get any legislation through. And this is something which, as I said before, you know, a year ago had broad support among Republicans and Democrats and doesn't anymore. So I think there will be great relief in the White House after all of this. I think Biden will immediately start pointing towards it as evidence of his great political brinksmanship. Really, the man that he's got to thank for making it all work for him is a Republican on the other side, and that's Mike Johnson. So I think we might see some increase in support for Biden among those who already think that Ukraine should be supported by the US, although those people are much more likely to be supportive of the president anyway. I think really this is not a great executive move. This has been all about what's going on in the House.
Thank you so much, Tony. Is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important for our listeners to hear?
I think Dom touched on it briefly in his opening remarks there, but it will be interesting to see how this plays in European capitals. We are expecting some kind of visit by the Prime Minister to Europe, in the UK Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, to Europe at some point this week to talk about all of this stuff. We had already seen Europe really gearing up to prepare to try and make up that shortfall from the US if this package couldn't get through. So what now happens to those plans, whether or not Europe continues to spend the kind of money that it was talking about spending before this went through, will be a very interesting question. And going forward, the big question, as I alluded to earlier, is what happens after November. This does fund the war for the next 7 months, but after that, it's kind of anyone's guess. And whether or not European capitals start putting in planning in place for that and start planning to ramp up their spending, assuming that a Trump presidency wouldn't continue it, is a very interesting one as well. So that's one that we're going to be keeping an eye on.
Thank you, Dom and Tony. One of the biggest economic issues facing Ukraine right now is how much money the state and businesses can attract from outside the country. Many efforts are being made to involve private investors and support existing Ukrainian businesses during the war. To understand the challenges and issues involved, I spoke to the Special Envoy on Investments, Innovations and War Risk Insurance from the Ministry of Economy of Ukraine. He's also the investment team lead at Advantage Ukraine, Oleksandr Griban. Here's our conversation.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Could you tell us then what you've been doing in the past couple of years during the full-scale invasion? What kind of work have you been focusing on?
Back then, I was the Deputy Minister of Economy, and primarily my major focus was the investments. And so, of course, it's a hard sell during the wartime. And at the same time, we were creative enough to try to focus on the most efficient absorption of the financial aid that was coming to Ukraine. During these last years, Ukraine managed to survive only due to financial support of international partners and common knowledge that Ukraine was fueling 50% of its spendings through the taxes we're collecting internally, and then the 50% were coming from the macrofinancial technical support. And whatever Ukraine was making itself, it was spending for the army. And then the rest, the social, the doctors, the teachers, etc., was on the shoulders of the donors. At the same time, in order not to use those who are fueling the army with taxes, part of the funds should have been redirected to the specific support of either through the lending instruments, which eventually happened through international financial institutions, development finance institutions, export credit agencies, and then direct support of the government, or where the government is then redistributing part of the aid through incentives or attractive conditions for the investors to come. But that was not so much implemented. And then the biggest issue, of course, is the political and war risk insurance, how to make this happen. Because even if you have the lending and the loans available, you still need to secure the equity. And then international equity without insurance is impossible in Ukraine. And so those were the questions I was focusing on.
You said in your answer there that it's a hard sell to persuade international investors to invest in Ukraine. I guess there's two parts to my question. One is, what precisely are they worried about? And how do you talk to them about those worries? How do you persuade them?
Well, the biggest worry in particular, it's not even the risk of the war per se. So it's not the risk of the missile hitting of your facility. Like, everybody understands that. Should you be a little kind of careful and pick it relatively distant from some regular targets, makes you safe from that. And we are actually preparing the massive launch of the war risk data sharing platform that was initiated in the consortium of National Security and Defense Council with the support of Marsh McLean. This is one of the instruments just to convince them. But what they're afraid more is the political risk now, because it basically means that the government, to some extent, is unpredictable. And it's not because the government wants to be so. It's because the enemy is unpredictable. And so the way the situation is going to develop might require some more radical decisions, right? Nobody knows where it's going to eventually drive into, because relatively you understand the ecosystem of security as it is, right? And so you already know what are the limits of the government in terms of current status quo, right? So for that, they need political risk insurance, which basically guarantees the potential loss of the investment. So if you're not getting your return on investment in the way that you were planning, basically means that you can then get the compensation of the balance that you lost. Normally is up to 90-95% of coverage, which is relatively fine in these conditions. Of course, this brings you to high risk, high yield, right? So this is always coming in a pair, and it's really the case for Ukraine. Now, with the viable business model, it means that after the war, you're going to be ready, you're going to be in the market, and then you can just do the massive jump, right? So these are the advantages. And that also mixes with the qualified skilled labor, which is here all the time, and especially in the technical and innovative spheres, and then properly located logistics. You see on the grain initiative that we're gradually kicking Russians out of the Black Sea, both physically and mentally. And I think it's going to be losing more and more ships. And now they're already afraid to be there. And in addition to that, we have the insurance instrument also backed up by Marsh and Lloyd's and Ukrainian banks, if you need this, right? So even the affordable insurance is there. So it's still a good hub for anything that is dealing with Europe and relatively close to Europe. And again, if we don't have any hiccups with the neighbors from the West as well, then probably it is a good idea to invest in Ukraine.
Do you find when you're talking to investors and talking to international companies and business people thinking about investing in Ukraine that you end up having to sort of explain the reality of what life is like on the ground? Do you encounter a lot of people who imagine that every single Ukrainian city looks a bit like Bakhmut and they don't know what they're getting involved with? How do you have those conversations?
Normally, you have some expat that's either working in Ukraine or has been to Ukraine or seen that life in Kyiv, and then it's easy to convince them. But basically, you convince them when you explain it even in a little bit of a technical way. So there is the conventional weapon outreach, right? Let's put it this way. So the rockets that we were facing yesterday morning, these are ballistics and ultra high speed, whatever. And this is different. They fly hundreds of kilometers. And the conventional weapon outreach is 50, 60 kilometers tops, right? Maybe up to 80. So just imagine Ukraine and then the battlefront and then at 80 kilometers, and this is your orange and red zones, like permanent ones. But the rest, due to this battlefront, lives normal life, and we're trying to survive because of that. If we don't run the economy, if we don't upkeep the consumption levels, if we don't maintain the production levels, the country's just going to vanish. Of course, to some extent, we're in a bit of a warm bath with all these supports, right? And one might think that this will be lasting forever. And of course, I like now that finally the international community is moving to the idea of dealing with Russian frozen assets. But then again, I think that we eventually might get access to the principal of that amount. And this will be fueling the restoration. And then they just need to take these decisions that the weapons could be financed. And then you can plan. You can say, okay, we have another 2 years, guys. And so within 2 years, we should do anything we can to survive without it.
Could you speak a little bit about the companies and the countries investing in Ukraine at the moment? Who's really going for it? Who should we be aware of that are putting their money where their mouth is?
So the large part of FDI inflows in 2022 and 2023 was reinvested earnings, meaning companies invested profit earned in Ukraine in order to support current businesses. Total FDI inflow in 2022 was as small as 556 million. 2022 by countries is like Switzerland, 362 basically, I think, is the holdings of Ukrainian businessmen just bringing the money back, and UK 262. And then Luxembourg, 252, that's the home for all the private equity funds. US, 215, France, 214. We don't have this data in 2023 yet by country. And then according to NBU Balance of Payment Report, net FDI inflows in 23 was already $4.2 billion, which is much higher than 2022. Reinvestment earnings, though, were 3.2, which means that Ukrainian businessmen primarily are those who believe in the country. They have the dry powder and put their skin in the game. And that's the perfect timing for the foreign companies, lenders, or equity partners to come, because Ukrainians are ready to take majority of the risk. They already risk most of the CapEx investments they do themselves. So it's a low-hanging fruit. And then some announcements and pre-investments were 3.2. Inflows in equity, 651. This is already a good one. And then the debt instruments, 523, primarily that's from international finance institutions, because till July, the debts for like intercompany loans were restricted. And some announcements in 2023 in terms of companies. So Grain Alliance, Colonel Nibelon invested $44 million. These are all Ukrainian companies. Unilever is investing $20 million in a new factory, construction of which will begin in 2024, because I think that their factory was damaged because of the Russian attack. Onur is the Turkish contractor that was quite active here in Ukraine building roads. They announced an investing $225 million in mining of mineral resources, including mining of graphite and kaolin. So the intent to invest $160 million also in green energy. And Norwegians are talking about wind, and I know that they have the ready-to-build projects. Local investors, again, the fuel retailers who are active in different fields of real estate as well, are investing to $500 million in a new ski resort in Ukraine, because the internal tourism is booming because of the restricted access out of the country for men.
Something you mentioned there, which is really interesting, about how you've got money coming in, you said the UK, Luxembourg, France, but you said that often this is Ukrainian businesses reinvesting back in, but also they're the ones taking on the risks. So just to translate that, does that mean you've got Western companies teaming up with Ukrainian companies, and the Ukrainian companies are saying, we're in country, we will do this, but we need your backing? Is that roughly how it's working? That sounds like quite a clever way to get around some of the issues.
When I say that these are mostly Ukrainian reinvestments, I mean that Ukrainian sponsors and UBOs are normally structured in foreign jurisdictions. So when he is a UBO, for instance, or a she, they might have a Switzerland or a UK-based LLP, limited partnership company, for instance, where they, as a limited partner, have a registered general partner who is managing their assets, normally is a resident of UK or Switzerland, whatever the other international country. But that's all transparent. So these high net worth individuals setting up the holdings in Switzerland or UK or, I don't know, Netherlands, that was before in Cyprus and BVI. Now it's just a little more civilized, I would say. They have the accumulated funds there, which they are now investing into the country, because they see that's the dry powder that they keep there. They don't keep it in the country. Before the capital controls, they were expatriating all the dividends there through the intercompany loans or the dividend structures, and they were just saving in international accounts. And then now they see the opportunities in Ukraine. They don't want to miss the market share, because, as I said, if you are investing in your resilience now in the business, you will then get 5x gain, right? This is a classic rule. And there are the businessmen that are normally doing this forever in Ukraine during the 30 years, and they normally buy the distressed assets and take control of the market shares. And then when the crisis is over, they are on the white horse selling everything. And you have a number of groups here that are always ready to come up with this fast liquidity. And some of them are in production business, some of them are like in the agricultural business, in the energy business. But when I also mentioned that it's a good time for international equity partners to come to Ukraine now, because again, these guys are already living by international standards. They all have audits, they have track record with international banks, KYC procedures, they're compliable. et cetera, et cetera. And they already took the first risk. They might invite internationals, strategic partners or private equity funds into the already existing business. So they're coming not for the green field, but for the brownfield of something. That is primarily because, again, of the political risk that the locals want to mitigate, having the international in the game. This gives them a little bit of a different perception already. And at the same time, they provide anything and everything it takes from the local partner in order to keep the business running. And then they're also coming with their own equity. But they would also count on the international partner to come with some leverage solutions, with some debts or new contracts or expertise, etc.
Could we speak about war insurance? Could you just explain to listeners who maybe don't have an economics background what exactly it is, how it works? But I'm especially interested in how it might have changed over the past 2 years, given the ebbs and flows of the war.
So here I would distinguish two types of insurances. There is conventional classic type of insurance when you have a property insurance, or you have the life insurance, or you have your car insured, right? So you're insuring an asset, you're insuring something tangible, and this is one type of insurance. This type of insurance is mostly dependent on the risk of the physical annihilation, which is then associated with direct war risk. So if something happens as an emergency case. For that, the conventional insurance companies that are willing to take some level of this risk, they are providing products that are probably 3 to 5 times higher than they should have been before. So if you want to insure the property, you need to pay 3 times premium than before the war. And then if you want to insure, for instance, the vessel with grain, it's a different story, because then it's also the increased risk of the missile hit, and then it requires additional reassurances. Because the way insurance market works is that whoever sells you the insurance evaluates the risk. So it says, like, risk is X. And so this X risk goes to the bigger insurance market where they're trying to resell it. They sell it to you for, I don't know, 10%, and then they're trying to resell it for 5 and make 5 margin. And then they're looking for buyer of this risk in a bigger portfolio, and then they trade it at some more incentives in order to soften this risk. So that's where you can start having reinsurance companies coming in, and they reinsure your risk, and they're also selling it. And eventually, at the end of this chain, there should be someone who is backstopping the risk. It's basically free money. So there should be the deposit of the funds that is untouchable unless this final risk happens. And this backstop, that's where part of the concessional funds that we get as a macro financial technical support, fueled by either taxpayers in Europe, US and Asia, to whom we are extremely grateful, or from the Russian assets that are frozen. And then you can just fuel them directly into bridging budget deficit alongside with giving money to EBRD, European Investment Bank, DFC, IFC, et cetera, to finance the private sector. And alongside with that, there should be the backstop, which will be securing this exposure for conventional insurance. And the same fund, but with slightly different rules, because there are different types of risk, should be existent for the political risk insurance, for the war risk insurance of your investment. Here, relatively, we have some movements, and then there are institutions that are selling political risk insurance as an instrument. There are local national agencies, like export credit agencies, or the governments are delegating some companies to manage their insurance products. For instance, PwC in Germany managing the war risk insurance for the German investors who come to Ukraine. They can buy the insurance and they can insure the return of their investment. So if you've invested 10 million euros and then you are getting, I don't know, 20% return on investment. So it takes you 5 years to bring the money back. And then if 1 year you don't get 2 million back, which is your plan, you get 1.5, you will have 90% of the half of a million compensated. So that's how insurance works, right? For investment insurance. If you have a property insurance, that's a different thing. You just get the money to restore your property. But in order to scale it, you need to have the backstop fund. This could be part of the Ukraine facility program that Europe is implementing, where they have $8 billion directed to support of the private sector. Ideally, they should come in a number of instruments. So they should come in concessional lending, which will then allow to give money not in the market rate, because currently euro and US dollars are very expensive because of the inflation processes. And even local Ukrainian banks can lend at 5-6% per annum. So one portion should go for concessional funding, so you could be getting loans cheaper than 6-5% per annum. The other portion should go for the equity support to the private equity funds, channeled maybe through DFIs as well. And then the portion should go for guarantees for the insurance pool, which should be then reinsuring all the other risks. And then exposure should be then redistributed through the whole network of insurance and insurance associated and financial companies. And then it will be scaled, and then the equity will flow. And if equity flows, then it multiplies the capital with the leverage, with the loan. So normally you bring 20-30% equity and you get 70% of your loan. Now it's sold 50-50 because of the risks. But even so, you just double your capital because of that. So
no, absolutely. Thank you for this crash course in investor economics. Just to finish then, what for you are the biggest challenges in the year ahead and how will you meet them?
The biggest challenges are the potential absence of the international support. So we should be counting more on ourselves, which is not an easy task because the economy is recovering. It is on the positive track, but it's not recovering so massively, 3-4%. So it's not 5-10% after having lost 30%, right? And we need to have just a little longer cushion in order to break this cycle. So I'm afraid that we might have unstable support. And this unstable support will slow down the economic growth and could eventually bring some of the Ukrainian companies and investors to the decision that they no longer want to stay in Ukraine. So some of the businessmen already looking for expansions on the European markets. And once they get the critical mass of their turnover that will be higher than Ukraine, they will be focusing more on that turnover. And so this may potentially happen. I have nothing against it in the long run because this makes Ukrainian business strong internationally and with the course of integration into European Union, this makes perfect sense. But on this stage, we'd rather have all the investors in because their taxes matter a lot. Or we should build a model that will then allow us collect the majority of those taxes that they're going to be making from sales elsewhere. We should not lose them because otherwise we're just going to lose everything.
Alexander, is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important for international listeners especially to understand?
So the NGO that is supported by USAID at the moment, we work with them as a major donor. What we do is we are professional investment bankers, private equity guys, like big four professionals, GR specialists. We know how to do business in the country. We know how to choose projects. So we provide the pro bono help for Ukrainian companies where we help them learn how to attract the capital, how to attract international partners. We are on the verge of a Ukrainian business coming to the wider horizons. We want them prepared. We want them to know how to work with the international vendors and partners and how to work with the capital. We maintain the database of feasible investment projects that we constantly update. So if you're looking for investment target in Ukraine, there you go, you can apply to us. So we just welcome you to us.
Alexander, thank you so much for your time. That was really fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the Latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message, and you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow-up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.